Welcome to Guerrilla Radio on CFUV 102 FM 104.3 on cable and heard around the world at cfuv.uvic.ca. There's no struggle that more typifies the 20th century than the war to preserve democracy. Fought in countries around the world, costing millions of lives, the Crusade witnessed the end of fascists, demagogues, and finally communism itself. But the blatantly undemocratic coronation of George W. Bush last January has many wondering, was democracy itself a collateral victim of the war? Though the mainstream media has largely lost interest in the judicial coup d'etat that brought the second Bush to power, disturbing tales of voter disenfranchisement and outright criminality by the Supreme Court ensure America will not forget the theft of the highest office in the land. On the first half of today's show, former L.A. Deputy District Attorney and author Vincent Bugliosi will be here to talk about his best-selling book, The Betrayal of America, How the Supreme Court Undermined the Constitution and Chose Our President. Mr. Bugliosi's previous bestsellers, Helter Skelter on the Prosecution of Charles Manson, Outrage, chronicling the O.J. Simpson trial, and No Island of Sanity on Ken Starr's persecution of then-President Bill Clinton, provide rare insight into the arcane world and workings behind the law. And in the second half, labor and human rights observers spent the last 2 weeks in Colombia as part of an international contingent of the Minga for Life and Against Violence, an effort to address the rapid deterioration of Colombia's civil society. Guy Pockington is with the British Columbia Government Employees Union and participated in the Minga. He'll be here in the second half to talk about labor at home and abroad on this Labor's Day. But first, looking beneath the robes of America's supremely criminal court. Welcome to the program, Mr. Bugliosi.
Happy to be on the show, sir.
Well, now, I guess we should begin with The Nation magazine. They say the reaction to your essay, None Dare Call It Treason, the indictment of the United States Supreme Court in the Bush versus Gore case, received the biggest reaction in their 136-year history. But I don't understand, having read it, how is this fraud possible?
You've asked the toughest question for your first question. I can tell you that the court did steal the election, but you're asking me, why are they getting by with it? It's mind-boggling, but no one can give you an exact answer to that, but I can speculate on a couple reasons. Jerry Spence, you know, the famous lawyer, he wrote one of the forewords with Molly Ivins to Betrayal of America, and just reading here from one of his lines, today for any lawyer, talking about American lawyers, who dares attack the judiciary harshly and publicly, the punishment may be professional death. So people are afraid to take on the United States Supreme Court. They're autocratic. There's nothing above them. You can't go any higher than them. Also, the media, the mainstream media, it's a group that can always be counted upon, Chris, to do a minimum of thinking. They've lost interest in this. They lost interest in it about a week or two after it happened. They didn't want to even talk about what the court did. And, of course, most people, and this may sound pretty harsh, but, you know, most people throughout the world are somewhat sheep-like, and they follow what the media says. So the media's lost interest, and therefore the majority of Americans have lost interest in this. And I'm the only public figure in America, and I hate to use that term because it sounds boastful, but by public figure I mean someone whose name is recognizable by a certain percentage of the population, who is calling these justices criminals. They belong behind bars and they should be impeached. Now, many people think they should be impeached. They're not public figures, and it'd be wonderful if someone with much more stature than I, like a Mario Cuomo or a former President Carter, would step up to the plate. But you've asked a tough question, why they're not doing it. They aren't doing it. At this moment that I'm talking to you right now, they've completely gotten away with it. Despite their monumental crime, they're still seated on the highest court in the land, and they're still treated with the utmost respect by the established institutions of America. But I point out in The Betrayal of America, and I think I make my point. Have you read the book, Chris?
Yeah, I have.
Okay, I think I make the point in the book that on December the 12th, five Supreme Court justices, there are nine here in America, committed one of the biggest and most serious crimes in America when they stopped the recount in Florida, took the election away from the American people, and handed it to George Bush. And here we got the American media saying, we're not going to cover this anymore, the election's over with. This is the same group of people, Chris, and this is not to defend President Clinton, the same group of people who pursued relentlessly Clinton not just day after day or week after week or month after month, but year after year for lying about a private consensual sexual affair. And here they're saying the election's over with, so we've gone on to other things. That would be like the Nazi war criminals at Nuremberg saying, you know, the war is over with, let's get on with our life. Obviously, the election being over with is not a defense to what these justices did. And with respect to what they did, I will stake my prosecutorial reputation, and I think it's a halfway decent one, on the fact that within the pages of the Betrayal of America, I proved beyond all reasonable doubt that these five justices deliberately set out to hand the election to Bush. This is not a closed case. Everything they did, they left their incriminating fingerprints everywhere.
Well, and I can't say that you're completely one man in the wilderness. Shortly after this coronation, 500 lawyers from across the country, the United States, wrote in and signed petitions saying that this was outrageous.
Well, yes. There's hundreds and hundreds of people that are saying that the court stole the election, that they're dishonorable, that it was politically motivated, but they're not willing to take that next step and say their conduct was criminal, they belong behind bars, and they should be impeached. There's no one else out there. Believe me, if there were, I would tell you about it. No, I'm the only public figure out there that is saying those three things.
Well, you know, your book was a really fascinating read, and this could be a difficult thing to convey to people like me who don't know a lot about the law, but there are a lot of intricacies and a lot of legal precedent here and there, and it can get boggling, but yours really read like a political thriller, and you're especially amusing when it comes to referring to the GOP or the Republican Party in the United States. Can you tell our listeners who may not be as familiar with the personalities down in the United States who some of the key players are for the Republicans?
You mean in the country? You mean I'm not a political. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
In so much as the people that were involved within the GOP,
yeah,
that masterminded, I guess I can safely say the word, this coup.
I don't think there was any conspiracy here or mastermind of the coup. We had five very conservative right wing justices who all were on the same page and knew exactly what they wanted to do. But the Republican Party in this country does not exist as we once knew it, when Nixon was president and Eisenhower. It's been taken over by the far right. And this is the group of people that Barry Goldwater, who wrote a book, Conscience of a Conservative, and very conservative, but he himself, near the end of his life, told the far right, these are the flag wavers and the fundamentalist Christians are always carrying a Bible and waving the flag. He told them, do not associate my name with anything that you do. You've hurt the Republican Party more than the Democratic Party. So the far right, they're the ones that have really taken over the Republican Party in this country. But I don't think this was a coup engineered by the far right. These are five Supreme Court justices who wanted Bush in, and they made sure that they were going to find a way to do it. But I've never said that Bush stole the election. What I'm saying is that the Supreme Court stole the election for George Bush. How do you defend these people, Chris? I'm talking about these five justices, when they themselves, in so many words, confessed to the crime. Now, how did they confess? Give me 30 seconds. I'll try to summarize it. They confessed by necessary implication when they said that their ruling that different standards to count votes in the various Florida counties violated the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution only applied, they said, to Bush v. Gore, not to any other case. But you see, Chris, if their ruling set forth a valid legal principle that was good enough for Bush v. Gore, why wasn't it good enough for other cases? Constitutional scholars all point out that this is the first time in the 210-year history of the court that the court limited its ruling to the case before it, saying it did not constitute legal authority or legal precedent for any other case. And that fact alone, Chris, and as you know, you read the book, there's much, much more evidence in the Betrayal of America to show what the court was up to. But that fact alone showed that these five justices were up to no good, that they themselves knew that their ruling was bogus and fraudulent and only a means to hand the election to Bush. Because, Chris, if that ruling was based on the law, there's no reason under the moon why they would have said it did not apply to other cases.
Well, yeah, basically this is under the present circumstances, right? And
yeah.
And what that says is that, okay, in this one particular case, though, there's
right.
no legal precedent in the history of the country.
Right.
And after we make this ruling, we don't want this to be a legal precedent for anything afterwards, but this is right just for this, just for now.
But I don't know if you realize, you're not a lawyer, how preposterous that is. I mean, it's unheard of. It's never been done before in the history of the U.S. Supreme Court. They showed, Chris, that they were up to no good 3 days earlier. On December the 8th, the Florida Supreme Court ordered a manual recount of about 60,000 undervotes. Those are the votes that are not picked up by the Votomatic machine for whatever reason, and you have to visually inspect them to see if the indication or the if there's a clear indication of the voter's intent.
This is the hanging chads and the dimpled chads and all
that. That's right, hanging chads, all types of things. And in fact, the newspapers in this country right now, they're looking at those, and they'll be coming out with their report fairly soon. That's the consortium of the LA Times, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, etc. Those votes should have been counted, of course, by the canvassing boards of the state of Florida, but they're being counted now by the newspapers. In any event, there was about 60,000 of them in the 67 counties of Florida, and the recount started the following morning, December 9th at 8 o'clock, and at that particular point, Bush's lead over Gore had shrunk to 154 votes, and at 2:10 in the afternoon, Justice Antonin Scalia steps in with an emergency order supported by the other four justices, and this is what he said, and you can't make this up. This is just too far out. It's just to make up. He said that we're going to stop this recount because if it continues, it could, quote, threaten irreparable harm to George Bush, unquote. So even though the election had not yet been decided, Chris, the unbelievable Scalia was presupposing that Bush had won the election, indeed had a right to win it, and anyone or any recount that showed that Gore had won would threaten irreparable harm to George Bush. Now, I would ask any conservatives in your audience to hypothesize a reversal of roles. Let's assume that Gore was ahead by 154 votes December 9th, 8 o'clock. Would Scalia have done the same thing for Gore he did for Bush? Who is Scalia? Well, again, we were talking about this a little while ago about the distinction in the Republican Party. He's not a typical Republican. He's not even a typical conservative. What he is, he's a right-wing ideologue of the Rush Limbaugh school. I don't know if you know who Rush Limbaugh is.
Yeah, we're familiar with that bag of wind.
He's the judicial darling of the far right of the Republican Party. To him, someone like Gore is anathema, probably an execration. It is absolutely inconceivable that Scalia would have said, we're going to stop this recount because if it continues, it could threaten irreparable harm to Al Gore. That would not have happened, Chris. And anyone who can tell me with a straight look on their face that it would have happened, I will personally nominate them for an Academy Award. Now, what that means when we say it would not have happened, and it's obvious it would not have happened, is that Scalia's ruling was not based on the law, because if it was based on the law, it would apply equally to both parties. So they've gotten by with murder, and I'd like to think, like most people, that I have a sense of justice, and I want to do everything within my power to make them pay dearly for their crimes. These people, Chris, had no respect, no regard for 50 million Americans whose votes for Vice President Gore they knew they were erasing as if never cast. And one point has to be made here. If the court had done for Gore what it did for Bush, I can give you a 100% guarantee I would have written the same identical book, The Betrayal of America. The book is not ideologically driven. I mean, I voted for John McCain. I didn't think too much of either Gore or Bush. But we cannot have the highest court in America telling the American people, you're not going to pick the president, we are.
Well, this is what really amazes me. I mean, obviously, the American Constitution is supposed to be the highest authority. It's the thing that Americans hold most dear.
Right.
And there's been a fair amount of thought gone into the to the crafting of this, as to checks and balances of
right.
power and everything
right.
else. But now, how could these guys walk in there and say, well, you know, we're going to do this? That they had to know that everybody would take a look at this and criticize it. I mean, the Supreme Court, are they now become the highest power in the land, literally?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. Well, where did they get the stratospheric arrogance to do that? We have three branches of government here in America, you know, judicial, executive, and legislative. And the Founding Fathers thought that they would be co-equal branches, but everyone knows now in America that the judicial branch is first among first among equals. These people, not just these five, but the court itself has intruded into every area of American life, and they are the last final word on everything. They've worn out several mirrors admiring the power that they've arrogated onto themselves, and now they apparently feel, and they are correct, they are correct, they apparently feel now that they literally can engage in serious criminal behavior and nothing's going to happen, and nothing so far has happened. I can tell you, however, that a national legal organization in America contacted me by letter a month or so ago, and I've since spoken to them by phone, and I'll be speaking at their national convention in Tucson on October 13th. And they're giving very serious thought to using my book, The Betrayal of America, as a legal basis for asking the House Judiciary Committee to initiate impeachment proceedings against these five justices. Now, I have to say, Congress is not going to impeach these five justices. They don't have the spine to do that. However, and I think this is the important point, any movement, Chris, towards impeachment and any consideration given by Congress to the impeachment movement, I think would have enormous sociological significance.
Well, now, you said earlier that this was not a conspiracy. I would argue that because Bush brought this case before them in the first place, knowing their sympathies, that
right.
that is a conspiracy. But
right.
that aside, in the book, you talk about Gore's defense team and the pitiful defense that they put
yeah.
up. Can you outline a little bit about how weak that defense is and maybe one postulation as to why they couldn't come up with something a little more substantial?
Yeah, well, I'm not the best writer in the world, and I have no ego when it comes to writing, but I do have an ego as a trial lawyer. But one of my lines that I've come up with, I think I used it in Outrage, the five reasons why O.J. Simpson got away with murder, is that if the average prominent lawyer in America, and it probably is true elsewhere, met their reputation out in the street, they wouldn't recognize each other. And there were some prominent lawyers representing Gore, but they bore no relation, as far as I know, to a competent trial lawyer. The lead lawyer, David Boies, he was on the Microsoft case. He may be an excellent business lawyer, a corporation lawyer, but, well, let me give you two arguments that he didn't make, obvious arguments that he should have made, and he did not make an oral argument. But I have to say this, no matter what argument he made, these five justices were up to no good, and they were going to come out with the same result anyway. But just as a part of the book, I pointed out that that Gore's legal team did not do a good job. But here are two arguments. What evidence could there possibly be, empirical, anecdotal, or otherwise, that different standards to count votes in the various Florida counties would hurt George Bush more than Al Gore? I mean, how could there possibly be any evidence to support that proposition? And obviously, Boies should have argued that to the U.S. Supreme Court. I mean, you'd literally have to be reduced to saying, you know, I just got this gut feeling that Bush is going to be hurt more than Gore. And if the court was not concerned about Bush, which we know they were, but if they weren't concerned about Bush and they were only concerned about the voters themselves, as they so fervently claim to be, then under what conceivable theory would the U.S. Supreme Court tell these voters in Florida, we're so concerned that some of you undervoters may lose your vote because of the different standards to count votes in the various Florida counties, that we're going to solve the problem by making sure that none of you undervoters have your votes counted? How preposterous can the court be? The court threw out all 60,000 undervotes. So the U.S. Supreme Court, and this could have been argued beforehand if the court intended to do something like that, the court, in effect, told 60,000 American citizens, we're going to protect your right to vote by not counting any of your votes. This just shows, Chris, that the equal protection argument was nothing but a legal gimmick to hand the election to George Bush. And, of course, Boies never made these obvious arguments.
Well, the equal protection, this is, again, back to the 14th Amendment, and this is what Bush's team hung their whole case on and what the Supreme Court finally
right.
used to overrule to
right.
the counting of ballots. But Chief Justice Rehnquist, he has been a fervent opponent of the 14th Amendment his whole career, hasn't he?
Of course.
He?
Oh, yeah. Most 14th Amendment cases are brought by minorities, people that have been discriminated against. And because the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment commands the federal government and states to treat people who are in the same group of people. similarly situated people. They're supposed to treat them equally. They're not supposed to discriminate against anyone. So what happens is blacks and minorities and disabled and people like that, they bring causes of action saying they've been discriminated against, and as a result of the discrimination against them, they've been deprived of something. So they go to court trying to have the court make them whole and give them what they were deprived of. And case after case after case, these five justices almost consistently rule against minorities when they bring equal protection cases. But I was going into the history of the equal protection clause to show you that the whole purpose of the clause is to make someone whole, make sure that the court gives them what they were deprived of as a result of the discrimination. Here, just the exact opposite happened. Mm-hmm. The court never gave these 60,000 voters anything. What they did, they took away their vote. They took away the vote of all 60,000 Floridians. So they turned the Equal Protection Clause on its head. It was just a legal gimmick, and we know it was a legal gimmick because the court itself, in effect, confessed to it by saying it doesn't apply to any other case.
That's what really amazes me. But could the blacks that were stopped by police and what they say they were hassled and blocked from going to the polls, intimidated from voting, could they use the 14th Amendment themselves?
Of course. There may be some lawsuits down in Florida. I know the U.S. Civil Rights Commission is still investigating the fact that some blacks were prevented from voting down in Florida, and they have not come out with their report yet. But I'm not sure if any action has literally been brought by the blacks in Florida. But they would have a cause of action. Yeah, anyone who's deprived of something and discriminated against, they have the right to go to court, right?
Well, now, if there's one character in this book that really, the real Lucretia of this whole piece is the nasty lassie from Tallahassee.
That's what I call her. Yeah.
That's your quote. Could you tell people up here just who this creature is?
Well, she was the Secretary of Elections down there in Florida. And she should have recused herself. She should have disqualified herself. Why? Well, not only is she Republican, but that's not grounds to recuse herself. But she campaigned for Bush in the New Hampshire snow. She was a delegate to the Republican National Convention in Philadelphia, and she was co-chairwoman of Bush's campaign in Florida. And she did everything possible to make sure that all the lawful votes were not counted. The Florida Supreme Court gave her, for instance, until a Monday morning at 9 o'clock if she didn't want to come in on a Sunday, and she has a reputation of not being the most diligent worker. Wait until Monday morning till all the votes come in, and no, she got in her car, drove down there on Sunday, and she wanted to make sure that votes coming in Sunday and early Monday morning would not be counted. So she was not representing all the people of Florida. She was only representing George Bush. Initially, there was a partial recount down there in Florida, and the recount was supposed to get in by 5 o'clock on a particular day. And what happened in a couple of the counties, they got the vast majority of their votes in before 5 o'clock, but not all of them. And she didn't count any of the votes that got in. She said, I will count all of them, or I will not count any portion thereof, without any legal authority to do that. So she was just a partisan person who should have recused herself.
Well, and that falls under the abuse of discretion under Florida law. Is
right.
It possible that Harris could at some time down the road be charged with this abuse of discretion?
Well, it's not a crime. You'd have to show a criminal intent. But certainly a civil cause of action could be brought against her. I don't know what the damages would be. No one's going to turn this election around because of her abuse of discretion down there. But I don't see any crime that she committed. But the five Supreme Court justices did commit one of the biggest and most serious crimes in American history. And their bias was so obvious. I mean, my God, pardon the use of the word God on radio. Anyway, the way I used it.
Yeah.
On the night of the election, Chris, November the 7th, Dan Rather gets on the air at 8 o'clock and says that it looks like Florida is going to Al Gore, whereupon Sandra Day O'Connor, she's at a cocktail party in Washington, D.C. with her lawyer husband, John, unguarded moment, she blurts out, "That's just terrible." Her husband was embarrassed, obviously, and explained to the guest why his wife was acting that way.
O'Connor, we should remind, there's another justice on the Supreme Court.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, she's one of the infamous five.
The
felonious five. He explains to the guest that he and his wife had wanted to retire to Arizona, and now they were going to have to wait for 4 years because she did not want a Democrat to appoint her successor. The Wall Street Journal found three guests to confirm that story. Newsweek found two guests to confirm it. Both the Wall Street Journal and Newsweek went to Sandra Day O'Connor for a comment, and she declined comment. Clarence Thomas. Here's someone, you know, that doesn't even try to create the impression that he's thinking. He's just a rubber stamp for Scalia. His wife works for the Heritage Foundation, a very conservative a think tank, political think tank in Washington, D.C. That Heritage Foundation assisted Governor Bush in his transition to power. Scalia has two sons that work for law firms that were heavily involved in the Bush campaign. These three justices had a duty under Title 28 of U.S. Code Section 455 to disqualify themselves, because if there's a conflict of interest or even the appearance of a conflict of interest, they have to disqualify themselves. They didn't do that. It was just terrible what happened here, and it's my guess that this would not have happened in Canada. Canada's too civilized, and I don't think this would have happened in Canada. I don't. I mean, this is unbelievable what happened here.
Well, I'd like to agree. Now, in the last 30 seconds, we have Mr. Bugliosi. Is there any hope that out of all this, I mean, people are going to have to hold their nose for 4 years with Mr. Bush, apparently, no matter what. But is there a hope that the Supreme Court itself can be reformed or changed in some way to avoid this kind of blatant partisanship?
Gee, I don't know. That's something that I have to do an enormous amount of thinking about, how we can prevent this type of thing in the future. The only thing that we can do right now is to make these people pay dearly for their crimes by an impeachment effort and things like that, and that would serve as some type of a deterrent to other justices in the future to make them think twice. But as of the moment that I'm talking to you, they have gotten away with it. You might tell your audience, I don't know if the book is available up there, The Betrayal of America, but it's available through Amazon.com, and it's in all the major stores here in the States, and I think it's in some of the stores up in Canada, but it's...
Well, you guys up here can pick it up. The name of the book, again, is The Betrayal of America, How the Supreme Court Undermined the Constitution and Chose Our President. That's Vincent Bugliosi that is the author of that best-selling book. It's 40 weeks now on the New York Times bestseller?
No, not 40 weeks, but it's gotten up as high as number four, and it is a bestseller, right?
Well, I'm sure that there's going to be more coming from this, and again, it was a very entertaining book.
I appreciate you having me on the show, Chris.
Well, thanks for coming on. Now, I want the rest of you to stick around. I'll be back after the break with Guy Pocklington, who was recently down in Colombia, and he's got some interesting things to say. Thanks again, Mr. Bugliosi.
Thank you, sir. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Come on, skinhead, rude boy. Yeah. Oh, no. It's that time again.
It's time for the 2001 Victoria Ska Fest. Enigmatica Entertainment and CFUV 101.9 FM presents an all-day affair down at Ship's Point in the Inner Harbor of Victoria on Saturday, September the 8th, between 1 and 10 p.m. The party starts at 1 o'clock in the afternoon with Nanaimo the Kilt Lifters, followed by Victoria's very own Chocomo Sound and the Bloodwarmers. From Edmonton, Alberta, Mad Bomber Society. From Provo, Utah, it's 2.5 White Guys. And all the way from distant Seattle, it's the fantabulous Easy Big Fella. And of course, topping the bill is NYC's finest, the New York Ska Jazz Ensemble. There will be fine food, a beverage garden, and a community trading tent, so make sure you bring down your mixtapes, artwork, personal knickknacks, or anything else you might like to trade, and get your tickets early for $22.50 at Lyle's Place, HMV, AMB Sound, and Ditch Records, or Blackball Records in Nanaimo, and Zulu Records on the mainland. The 2001 Victoria Ska Festival is generously supported by HMV, Extreme 107.3, Exclaim Magazine, Lighthouse Brewery, the Merredale Estate Cidery, Urge and Universal Tattoo Studios, The Times Colonist, Brickyard Pizza, Monday Magazine, and of course, the City of Victoria and CFUV 101.9 FM. With a late night after party to follow, the 2001 Victoria Ska Fest will surely become the Festival of the People!
Que ustedes comparten los weekends.
Se escaparon la muchacha de la casa.
Se le
vacila con el negro de la esquina que no se quiere para nada. Toda con su mini falda, zapatillos de charrón, se tiraron para la calle las niñitas de Ramón. Se taparon las muchachas, en la pista se le ve con un grupo de varones que se la van a comer. En su casa se pensaban que ya estaban dormiditas, pero en realidad ya estaban moviendo la caderita.
La muchacha de la casa,
no son niñas, son mujeres.
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio on CFUV 102 FM 104.3 on cable. And, you know, we're heard around the world at cfuv.uvic.ca. Now, the forced unemployment policies of the neoliberal agenda has meant hard times for working and non-working people alike. Cutbacks, outsourcing, stagnant wages, and regressive labor legislation have all contributed to plummeting living standards here in Canada. But it's much worse for unionistas abroad. Guy Pocklington has seen the labor world from both sides. He's just returned from Colombia, where an international delegation of labor and human rights observers participated in the Minga for Life Against Violence, or for Life and Against Violence, rather, a mobilization of civil society and indigenous groups down there, urging an end to the killing in their country. Welcome to the show, Guy.
Good afternoon.
Well, Guy, can we start off? What's it like being a labor guy down in Colombia right now?
Well, it's pretty frightening if you're a labor leader in Colombia. When we got there a couple of weeks ago, there had already been 85 labor leaders killed since January 1st. The third day we were there, there were two more killed. Over the remaining 3 weeks, there was another three killed, bringing up to 90. And I just got an email from Coot, the Labor Central in Columbia, saying two more people had been killed, so it's up to 92 now.
So we're looking at three or four labor leaders a week being murdered.
Exactly, yeah, and that's to say nothing of all the other kinds of kidnapping, threats, intimidation, and forced displacements.
Well, what's behind all this?
Well, mainly what's behind it is the attempt to silence any opposition, it's all part of Plan Colombia and the Andean Initiative, with the pretext of the war on drugs. People are being forced out of the countryside to give transnational corporations access to oil, gold, other minerals, hydroelectric power. So that's mainly what's going on.
Well, I know that there's a lot of American corporate interest in Colombia. As you mentioned, it's a very rich place. Its natural resources are rich. It's got apparently a lot of people that need work coming out of the countryside to work in these factories and free trade zones and so forth. One of the most notable, at least lately, American corporation down there is Coca-Cola, our favorite soft drink. Do you want to tell us a little bit about Coca-Cola's involvement in Colombia and what it's meant for Colombian labor?
Yeah, among many different groups that we met with, we met with most of the executive of Sinaltrainal, which is the acronym for the Food Workers Union in Colombia, and they have some of the Coca-Cola bottling plants organized, and some other of our international favorites like Nestle and Pepsi.
The Nestle, the company that brought mother's formula to polluted waters of Africa and beyond?
That's the one.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Just to give you some idea, the union's existed since 1982. At one point it had 4,500 members, and now it's down to 2,500, mostly because of the repression of anybody who dares to join a union. They've had 20 members of the union killed. Six of those were from Coca-Cola. 25 in prison, 9 other death attempts, 29 displaced, and they've had 14 break-ins at their office. There's been 5,000 workers fired from Coca-Cola in the past 10 years. But the level of what they called impunity, The chances of getting prosecuted for anything in Colombia is so slim. I think it's like only 3% of murders are ever prosecuted. The killings take and all the other intimidation is mostly at the hands of the right wing paramilitary forces, which are closely linked to the army. They sort of carry out the illegal dirty work that the army can't do itself.
Well, now you say they're closely linked to the military. Can we establish firm and solid and punishable links to American corporations and the paramilitaries?
Well, because the level of prosecution is so low, it's difficult to get what at least the mainstream media would accept as adequate proof that this takes place. But this is really widespread. I mean, we're just talking about one particular union and one company within that. But to give you an idea, the 20 people who have been killed have all been reported to the authorities. Of those 20, 19 are still in the preliminary investigation stage, and some of these go back 16 years. So you can see what the chances are. There is one thing going on; it's quite interesting, actually. The steelworkers is assisting Sinaltrainal to bring an action against Coca-Cola in a Miami court. The president of Sinaltrainal said that they had considerable evidence linking the manager and some other people of the Coca-Cola bottling plant directly to the murder of one of the union leaders.
Well, now, this is the thing with Coca-Cola, and I've read horrific stories about the Coca-Cola bottling plants in Guatemala, and I'm sure it happens all over the world, wherever they are. But they say, well, look, I mean, we don't own these bottling plants. They're their own free agents. It's got nothing to do with us. How about that argument?
Well, I'm sure that that's one of the arguments they'll use in the court case. I mean, that's exactly what they said in Guatemala and elsewhere around the world, that this, you know, has nothing to do with us. That's what the Colombian government says, too. You know, whenever anyone tries to link the actions of the paramilitaries to the military, they deny it. It has nothing to do with us. But, I mean, basically the paramilitaries are getting funded through Plan Colombia, which has put, I think, $3 billion into the hands of the Colombian military. So that gets to the paramilitaries, as well as the big landowners and transnational corporations.
So, I mean, everybody can see what's really happening. We've got very wealthy corporations in the United States giving money to legislators in that country who in turn order their spending to go to places that are, it's friendly to that industry, right?
Yeah, and it's not just the U.S. There's lots of Canadian corporations involved, too.
Yeah, tell me a couple of goodies.
Well, the ones that I heard mentioned most often were Corona and Conquistador. I believe they're involved in gold mining. There's Alberta Energy in oil, and there's several other companies. I can't remember the names right now.
Well, I've got in front of me a little piece of bad news about an American mining company called Drummond. They're from Birmingham. Their CEO said, "Well, you know, there's some problems down there, but nothing we can't keep a lid on, you know." And they have also suffered with union leaders being murdered and disappeared and so forth.
Right, and the situation is even worse for peasants. There's estimated that over 1,000 peasant leaders have been murdered once again since the beginning of this year. There's about 1.5 million people living in Bogota who have been forced off the land.
Well, now this gets back to the Minga. Now, you participated in the Minga. Can you tell the listeners what exactly that's all about?
Yeah, there was 30 of us from across Canada. The delegation was made up of Indigenous peoples, women, people from women's groups, trade unionists, NGOs, Afro-Canadian, some church groups. So, you know, pretty broad spectrum. And we went to Colombia. We were, the first couple of days, we went to a city called Barranca Bermeja, where the two large national women's organizations were holding a conference against war. There's about 2,000 women from around the country there, plus 100 international delegates, including the 30 of us. Now, this is an area that's controlled by the paramilitaries, so it was quite courageous of them to put it on. Like, it was really an in-your-face kind of operation, and quite dangerous for them.
And what were your impressions? Did you ever feel that you were in any kind of danger, or was the paramilitary or military presence kept in the background?
Well, actually, they had a demonstration in front of the place where the conference was being held. Now, I mean, what they do, and the press does this, is any popular movements, any popular resistance of any kind is linked to the guerrilla movements, and, you know, and said that. You know, this is just a front for the guerrillas. But through diplomatic means, there was I guess some phone calls made, and they disappeared. And when I say that the area is under the control of the paramilitaries, it's not the way they operate. Like, you don't see people in uniform standing on every street corner. It's far less visible than that. It's done through a campaign of terror. There will be leaders of different movements that will be kidnapped and brutally murdered as a signal to anyone else who might get involved.
Well, this really is terrorism in its purest form, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's how the whole society works. And it has other consequences, too. I mean, because of the level of militarism and the fact that that state institutions, like the courts, really reach a very small part of the population, there is a lot of violence that's not directly connected to the military operations that goes on. So there's a lot of violence against women in the homes and sometimes disputes between neighbors can even end up in murders because there's no other dispute resolution process.
Well, now you. I've done a lot of shows on Colombia, and it's just it's from bad to worse. Was there any hopeful signs down there that you could see that this movement is having an effect, or that it's going anywhere?
The breadth of the popular organizations is quite incredible. We met with the leaders of hundreds of different organizations, and in different sectors, and peasants. Peace groups, Afro-Colombians, trade unions, and the courage and the level of analysis of these people was quite mind-boggling and very heartening. While we were in Barranca Bermeja, there's a big oil refinery there, and we went and met with people just on the shop floor, and these were ordinary working guys and women, and they were talking about neoliberalism. I wish that were the case in BC. That level of understanding.
Well, now that they did get thousands of people out during this Mingo, they blocked the major intersections, arteries, and we're talking not a couple hundred people, not a couple thousand, but literally like thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of people. And yet up here, the media didn't, I didn't hear one single peep. Is that disheartening to you?
Well, yeah. I mean, because of the, virtual total silence about Colombia and the media here, I think most people, when they hear about Colombia, all they know about is coffee and cocaine, and that's about it.
And, well, coffee and cocaine are pretty central to this whole issue as well, and so much of those are big cash crops, and they're controlled by two different factions, right?
Well, the coca trade is important, but I think much too much is made of it. There's some rich families and you with the help of U.S. bankers and whatnot involved in narco trafficking, but the vast majority of the population are peasants. Many of them have been forced into growing coca, and it's their fields, of course, that get the aerial spraying, and forcing them into greater and greater poverty.
Well, this is another great cash cow for American corporate interest: is the fumigation of the entire countryside. By the sounds of it, can you give us a little more information on what's going on around the fumigation and who's behind it?
Well, it's all part of the so-called war on drugs, and I mean, there's just been vast territories, particularly in the Amazon basin, that have been sprayed. But as I said before, the real purpose is to run people, run peasants off the land. But because what happens is that it does kill the coca crops, but nothing else can be grown on the land. And that's what forces people off the land and into the cities is that they can't grow anything. They can't grow corn and yucca and plantains and all the staples of life in Colombia.
Well, as a matter of trying to turn things around and turning them around from outside the country, you mentioned the United Steelworkers of America have brought a case against Coca-Cola in the States, and you also mentioned that there are big Canadian corporations operating in Colombia, and no doubt there's nasty-ass things going on in their little areas of operation. Is there, to your knowledge, any Canadian counterpart to the United Steelworkers who are willing to
to bring some of the Canadian corporate actors into Canadian courtrooms?
Well, I'm not sure it could be done under Canadian law. I mean, the steelworkers are making use of some law in the States from the, I think it's from the 1700s, which allows U.S. corporations to be sued in American courts for activities in a foreign country. So I'm not sure the same thing could happen here. But certainly, you know, there are the CLC and the auto workers and other unions in Canada are doing things with the Colombian trade union movement to assist it.
And how do our listeners, if they want to talk to Ottawa, can they go through some of these union organs that you mentioned to get more information and maybe get a little help in directing their inquiries to the government?
Certainly, and also an NGO here in Vancouver called Co-Development Canada.
Co-Development Canada, and they're on the internet, I expect.
That's right, yes. Yeah.
Well, now it is Labor Day, and Colombia is not the only country that's having labor reversals. We've seen here the federal PSAC unions out, the nurses, the bus drivers. What's your take on labor in this country in 2001?
Well, certainly in our province, I think things are gonna start heating up as the Liberals start making greater and greater cutbacks to make up for the tax cut that they gave to rich people.
And they rewrote recently, and I haven't even had a chance to read this, but the labor code in British Columbia has had a bit of revision at the hands of our charging Liberal government. Are you familiar with any of the details about that?
Well, I mean, basically what they've done is to make it more difficult for unions to organize by ending the sort of automatic certification when you had 55% sign up. So what that does is it allows the boss to get in there and intimidate people before a vote is taken.
Well, and this has a lot to do with the anonymous polls and so forth as well, does it not? It was secret ballots in the past, and again, I'm just shooting from the hip here. I haven't read the changes, but from what I understood, that there wasn't going to be secret balloting anymore or something like this. If you were voting in your workplace, you had to stand there and hold up your hand so that your employer or...
No, we haven't quite reached the stage of Mexico. No, what was taken away was before, if a union signed up 55% of the workers in a workplace, there would normally be an automatic certification. But now a union could sign up 100%, and it still goes for a vote. It's just that in the intervening period between the application for certification and when the vote takes place, it allows the boss to take measures to intimidate people.
Well, and how about your own dealings now? You're with the British Columbia Government Employees Union. You're going to be dealing with this new government. What's coming, what's in the wind with various relations between your union and the government now?
Well, as I said, I think what we're going to be looking at is privatization and cutbacks to social services and loss of jobs for our members. It was remarkably similar talking to the leaders of the Federation of Workers of the State in Colombia, and they were facing exactly the same thing.
Well, and that is that a coincidence, you think?
No, not at all. I think it's all part of the same agenda.
Well, yeah, it's hard to talk about this and say, well, you know, this is a single mindset that is far away in Colombia or here or in South Africa or in any of the places around the world where we see labor facing the same thing, like huge government privatization cutbacks, is there a solid plan in the union movement in Canada to try to address this globalizing force?
No, I would say that it's still fairly fragmented. There are signs that are coming together, and with some of the national federations of unions, and hopefully that will continue, because I think things are only going to get worse.
Well, I saw an advertisement on television today. It was a promotional piece for teachers and teaching. It wasn't necessarily a union supportive kind of ad, but although I expect that your union had something to do with the creation of these ads, am I right?
I'm not sure.
Okay. So where are the teachers in this province now? Are we going to be looking at some kind of labor disruption in the near future with the education system in British Columbia?
Well, my understanding is that I was out of the country, but that there was legislation passed that make it more difficult for teachers to take strike action. So I would hazard a guess that the combination of the government wanting to control the wages of teachers and their inability to legally take strike action is probably going to result in some heating up of labor relations between the BCTF and the government in the near future.
Well, it always strikes me as funny. If these services are so essential, then why not pay people a little bit better to do them?
Well, I'm sure that the nurses and the paramedical professionals would agree with you.
Well, so now, do you plan to go back down to Columbia anytime in the near future?
Not in the very near future. I think for those of us who went on the delegation, our work is cut out for us in Canada in the next while to do our best to publicize the situation of workers and other popular sectors in Colombia, in this country, and we do have plans to bring up some people from the trade union movement, but also from the indigenous and peasant sectors to do a speaking tour in Canada.
Well, we'll be looking for that because I'm sure that they've got things that would curl our hair up here. A lot of the people, as you say, the media just doesn't seem able to cover it. But unfortunately, Guy, we're out of time for today. But I'd like to thank you for coming on.
My pleasure.
And I also want to thank Vincent Bugliosi for coming on. His book, again, The Betrayal of America. He wanted me to tell you it's available at Amazon.com for those of us in Canada who he wasn't sure if we got books over here or something. I'm not sure. But thanks again, Guy, for coming on. And I want everyone else to stick around because Jazz is going to be up next. Thanks, Guy.
Thank you.